We'll hear arguments next in Moorman Manufacturing Company against Bayer. Mr. Barnes, I think you may proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this is an appeal from a decision of the Supreme Court of Iowa upholding that state's taxing scheme, which has the purpose and effect of imposing a tariff on imports while subsidizing exports. The case differs from General Motors Corporation against District of Columbia, which this Court decided in 1965, only in irrelevant factual details, and that the issue here is purely constitutional, whereas the Court was able to decide the District of Columbia case on statutory interpretation. The appellant is the Moorman Manufacturing Company, which is an Illinois-based corporation with the business of manufacturing animal feeds, which it sells to farmers and others. It has warehouses and salesmen in Iowa, but no manufacturing in that state. Everything sold into Iowa is manufactured in Illinois. The corporation paid the Iowa corporate income tax, computing its apportionable income in the manner prescribed in the Iowa statute, as to which there's no dispute. And then it apportioned that income following the three-factor formula of the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act. That is a formula of property, payroll, and sales equally weighted, with the sales assigned to the destination, in this case, Iowa. The assessments are for the difference between the tax as thus apportioned and the Iowa formula. The Iowa formula provides for a single sales factor by destination, not attributing anything to either property or payroll. The Iowa statute starts with federal taxable income and makes certain adjustments in it. Then, having done that, it applies a fraction, numerator of which is Iowa sales, and denominator sales to customers all over, to that amount of total income. And this has the effect of attributing to Iowa all of the income which is derived from the manufacture in Illinois and the sale to customers in Iowa. There is no income, no tax on income from an Iowa manufacturer selling into Illinois. All the facts are stipulated, the total taxable income, the apportionment fractions, any one of the three apportionment fractions, the amounts of tax which will be due if the statute is held constitutional, and also the amount of tax which will be due if it is held unconstitutional. So that the sole question in the case is the constitutionality of a single sales fraction. The appellee agrees with that. That appears in his motion to dismiss and also in his brief.
Mr. Barnes, I just had one question there. If the statute is unconstitutional, why do you owe any tax?
We don't owe any tax more than we already paid.
But why did you have to pay any at all?
Because we Mr. Justice Stevens, the statute imposing tax is not unconstitutional. The only thing that's unconstitutional is the apportionment formula, so-called apportionment formula.
But you say that the Constitution mandates the formula, the three-party formula that you used in filling out your returns?
No, Mr. Justice Stevens, we don't call on the court to impose a formula or perform any other legislative function. We merely say that the single sales factor is unconstitutional. And that's all that the court is asked to do.
And you had, and if that's correct, then as my brother Stevens has indicated, you would owe no tax under the Iowa statute, and yet you voluntarily paid a tax, didn't you?
I wouldn't go that far, Mr. Justice Stewart. I think the statute is perfectly valid except for this apportionment formula. And the statute not only says that I shouldn't say apportionment, there is no apportionment. This single factor sales formula of attribution, I think, is unconstitutional. But the statute also says that in the case of interstate commerce, the taxpayer shall pay a reasonable portion. And so I think that knocking out the formula does not knock out the statute nor the liability. It just leaves a question as to how it will be computed.
Well, how can it be then? Has the taxing agency any authority to set up a different formula?
Yes, they do.
They do.
Yes, they do, in the statute.
And you'd suggest they could compute the tax on some three-factor or other formula?
Well, that's what we've agreed on. But the statute, almost all these statutes in all states, contain a provision that if there's something wrong with a statutory formula, the commission or the director can work out something that fits in a particular case. A prime example was the one in California, the McDonnell-Douglas case. California statute provided that the property factor is going to consider only owned property. McDonnell-Douglas owned a big factory in California, and they leased a big factory in another state. And they said it's not fair to attribute all of our property to California when we're using this property in another state, and the California Supreme Court agreed. This was a case in which the statute was improper in its application in a particular case. So the statutes permit that all along, including the Iowa statute.
And you have paid a tax to Iowa based on a three-factor formula?
That is right. We did not pay on the additional assessments. We filed an appeal bond instead. All the other states, including Illinois, not all, but all the ones that are pertinent, including Illinois, use this three-factor formula of property, payroll, and sales.
When you say all the states that are pertinent, you mean the ones in which your client is subject to taxation?
I made that qualification because there are one or two states that, while using three-factor formula, apply some different weights, and there is one state which has adopted the only really sound formula, which is property and payroll with no sales in it. That's West Virginia.
Are you saying that because so many other states have adopted the three-factor formula, Iowa is under constitutional mandate to do the same thing?
No. What we say is that they're under constitutional mandate not to adopt something different which imposes a double tax on interstate commerce.
Well, but supposing every state in the union had adopted Iowa's formula, could you make the same argument that you're making now that Iowa's formula is unconstitutional?
Yes, because the taxes would be being paid all to the wrong states, which is a due process problem.
How can you tell what the wrong states are?
There wouldn't be any double taxation in that case,
yeah.
But you'd still have taxes going to places that are unrelated to where the income was earned and to where the governmental services were rendered.
Well, but certainly there would be some nexus between the taxes collected and the earning of income.
No, there is no nexus question in this case. We agree to the nexus. And you could have a very tiny nexus, and the same problems would arise. The question is not whether a tax is owed, but how much. And the measure is entirely our problem. Now, this is
you've got to show that Iowa's proposed measure is unconstitutional, not just that you don't like it or that you would have done something else if you were a legislator.
That's right. I think we have no difficulty with that. The hypothetical which this court used in its opinion in the General Motors District of Columbia case is applicable here. Assume that the particular manufacturer does all its manufacturing in Illinois and it sells only to customers in Iowa.
Mr. Barnes, you argued the General Motors case.
I did, sir.
You have two of them? Or not?
You remember, Mr. Justice White.
I should, yes. Washington and District of Columbia?
Correct. And I tried again, but you wouldn't take it.
But you won the Washington.
I lost Washington, won the D.C. In that situation, all manufacturing in Iowa and all customers in the District of Columbia, in Iowa, Illinois would tax two-thirds of the income by applying its property and payroll factors. It wouldn't apply the sales factor because the sales were all outside the state. And Iowa would tax 100% of the income because it attributes all income to the locus of the customer at a total of 166%. As I say, that hypothetical I have taken from GMC against District of Columbia. Now, this shows the fallacy of the Iowa argument. They're making the same error that the Court of Appeals made in the GMC case, namely that because the unrelated income is not taxed, income is apportioned. The fact is that 100% of the related income is taxed. Now, they say, for instance, Moman has a factory in Texas that sells to Texas customers. By not taxing any of that, they say, well, Moman's entire income is apportioned. But apportionment of the entire income is irrelevant. What counts is the income on the segment of the business that consists of manufacturing in Illinois and selling to customers in Iowa. The sales fraction, of course, does not do any apportioning. It merely identifies the income from that segment of the business. Taken by itself, it taxes 100% of that income. Now, a sales factor is economically illegitimate in any case, but it's tolerable if combined with property and payroll factors, which do measure the income-producing activity and which also measure the burden on governmental services.
Well, this again is a constitutional argument, I think, not just an economic argument.
Yes, because as we have attempted to point out, the constitutionality of things in this area have to take into consideration economic realities, among other considerations. That is, the Constitution rests on the constitutional requirements rest to a considerable degree on the economics.
Your basic constitutional claim, as I understand it, Mr. Barnes, is that what Iowa has done results in the double taxation of interstate commerce.
That is the interstate commerce argument. There's also a due process
point
because they're reaching outside their geographical borders to grab something from another state.
And precisely how does this double taxation, as you refer to it, take place? How do you define double taxation?
That was the hypothetical that I went through a minute ago, maybe rather clumsily. Illinois uses this three-factor formula, which is universal except for Iowa. And if we manufacture in Illinois, Illinois will attribute to itself two-thirds of the income derived from that part of the business because it will apply a property factor and a payroll factor. Iowa, then, as the shipments into Iowa, attributes 100% of the income to itself because it attributes all of it to the location of the customer.
So you're talking, you say that if the same income is attributed to more than one state, it's double taxation.
Yes, constitutionally impermissible.
What case supports that?
There are many cases that touch on this particular subject, most of them not in this precise context. Now, of course, the best description of the situation is General Motors against District of Columbia. The only trouble with that is that the court was able to decide it on a statutory ground, which cannot be done in this case. Freeman against Hewitt is a case in which a different type of tax was struck down because of the mere danger of a double taxation by a second state.
Do you think Freeman against Hewitt is still good law after our recent decisions in the last two or three years?
Yes, I don't know of any decision that that attacks the conclusion in that one. That was outshipments. Now, the recent decisions that have upheld a tax of somewhat that same type have been on in-shipments. Freeman against Hewitt isn't the only case, of course. The Adams against Storen is another one. Gwynne, White, and Prince against Hannaford is still another. And there are a great many.
Mr. Barnes, supposing you had a neighboring state next to Iowa that had a two-factor formula, payroll and property, and Iowa had the one-factor formula, sales. Would both statutes be unconstitutional? And all this, and say that all the goods are manufactured in the two-factor formula state and shipped into the one-factor formula state. Would both statutes be unconstitutional?
No. What you would get in that case
you'd
would
have
be...
100%, you'd have 200%
100%
taxation.
Duplication, 200% right. Instead of the 166 that we have here. The rule has long been that what one state does doesn't make much difference to what another state does.
Then they'd both be bad.
But, well, then the conclusion usually is they're both good. But you pose an extreme case, and there is something in that case to uphold the neighboring state's two-factor formula. You know, West Virginia, they don't neighbor on Iowa. They ship things up there. The fiscal soundness, economic soundness of the property and payroll factors would throw a terrific burden on the state of Iowa to justify its own sales factors, and it can't meet that burden. Furthermore, the two factors, while differing from the three factors used by the majority of states, is very close to what is done by the majority of states. It attributes income to the sources of capital and labor, which this court has often said are the sources of income.
But, Mr. Barnes, what I'm asking is, does your argument rest on the overlap, where you get to, and which seems to me would make both statutes unconstitutional, or are you arguing quite a different argument, that the sales factor just isn't justifiable because there's not enough activity in the state? If you're arguing overlap, I don't see what difference it makes which factor you use. Anyone would be unconstitutional if it's not the same as the neighboring state.
The difference is that I don't think both statutes would be unconstitutional in your case. I think that the sales state tax would be unconstitutional.
But doesn't your overlap argument apply equally to both states?
It does, and it puts a burden on both states to prove the validity of its method of doing it. And I think that the state that uses property and payroll can easily prove it, and the state that uses sales can't come anywhere near proving it.
But are you then saying that if every state in the country used a purely sales method, every state statute would be unconstitutional? And then you don't have to rely on overlap at all.
That's right. That would eliminate the double taxation. I think Mr. Justice Rehnquist asked me a question similar to that. But what it would do would be to result in the taxes being paid to the wrong states, because there isn't any basis for attributing taxes on income to the locus of the customers, which is what that would do.
But see, you've got two quite different theories, and I'm trying to understand which one you're really resting on. One is an overlap double taxation theory.
Right.
The other is that sales isn't any good no matter how it's done.
Right.
That's right.
And which is your principal argument?
On the interstate commerce phase of the case, the overlap.
Like that's the one that anyone will win. Right?
And, of course, the...
But you rely equally on the due process
issue, I take it. That's a sales factor, just taxes income earned in another state.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
We've said enough about the sales tax, sales fraction, not apportioning. A tax is justified only by governmental services. In the case of corporations, services to corporations. And the sales factor is unrelated to services. It doesn't in any way measure the burden which the corporation imposes upon the state. Income, as this court has often said, is a product of capital or labor or both. And the sales factor is unrelated to that. Selling effort, of course, produces income, but that's measured by capital and labor. The Iowa formula has no relation to selling effort. It has no relation to the warehouses and inventories, nor to the salesman employees that are in the state of Iowa. Tax would be the same if there were no property or payroll in Iowa. It would also be the same if Mormon were to pick up its entire Illinois factory and put it in Iowa. It would not increase the tax in the slightest. The effect of the formula, then, is to tax capital and labor, which is in Illinois, and again impose the tariffs on imports and subsidize the exports, and in conjunction with Illinois to cause a double tax. In the powerful brief of our 15 distinguished economists, that economic fallacy in the sales factor is pointed out, the tariff on imports, an inducement to trade war with resulting injury to common market. Now, since our last brief was written, our attention has been drawn to an activity in the state of Minnesota which shows that the trade war, which was theoretically envisioned by the economists, is actually going on. Minnesota had permitted manufacturers such as Moorman shipping into Minnesota to use the standard three-factor formula, equally weighted, property, payroll, and sales. Now they have a bill pending which would force Moorman and others similarly situated to use a three-factor formula, but only 15% property, 15% payroll, and 70% sales. The report that I get is that this is done in retaliation for Wisconsin's recent changing the weights in its formula and increasing the weight on sales from one-third up to one-half.
How much latitude do you think the Constitution allows the various states in using one, two, or three formulas and in weighting the formulas?
I think that the decisions of this court and of other courts have upheld minor overlap, particularly where the overlap is not directly intentional. It just happens to result from a different way of doing things. That can happen under a three-factor formula equally weighted because of different definitions of some parts of the formula, but it doesn't produce any very serious overlap. In this case, we have a serious overlap. It's 141% in one of the years, and there is nothing just incidental about it. It's intentional, a deliberate intention to impose a tariff on imports and subsidize exports. Referring to that Minnesota thing again, a very peculiar provision in that statute or bill, such pending bill, as it has been reported to us orally, we haven't seen it, is that it contains a provision that will not take effect if Moorman succeeds in this case.
Well, how what impact does this sales factor have with respect to the competition between Iowans and people from Illinois?
The effect on competition is nothing in which we can measure. At this point, all we can do is look at it theoretically.
You say it's a tax on imports. It's a tax on imports because you say both Illinois and Iowa are taxing the same income. And so the tax bite on Moorman is higher.
Even if Illinois were not taxing the same income, as a matter of fact, the first 2 years in this appeal, they didn't. Corporate income tax came in later. It still is a tax on imports because it is attributing to Iowa 100% of
the... But does it help Iowans control the Iowa market?
That results if there is another tax, as there is in this case.
Yes.
Because Moorman has to pay tax on 166% of its income, and Iowa
manufacturer... So it makes it less able to compete in the Iowa market.
That's right. And an Iowa manufacturer wouldn't pay that. But the biggest boon is to the Iowa manufacturer who sells into Illinois or some other place, because he doesn't pay any tax to Iowa at all. And only one-third of his income when it gets into Illinois because of the application of the sales factor in that case. Now, in many states do it one way, and Iowa does it another.
You think there's a discrimination then against interstate commerce or not?
Yes, there is.
Is that an independent basis for invalidating?
No. It isn't independent of the overlap.
You think it's the same?
The overlap is what illustrates and is the consequence of the discrimination against interstate commerce. As I said, when Iowa does it one way and all the other states do it some other way, Iowa has to give away unless Iowa can clearly establish that it's right and the others are clearly wrong.
Well, but in other words, Iowa's constitutional right to tax, or the constitutional limitations on Iowa's power to tax, is affected by the means chosen by other states.
That is true. And Iowa, since it's so different from everybody else, has the burden of proof of showing that it's right.
Well, I thought that every state enactment was presumed constitutional.
So?
So why does Iowa have the burden of proof?
Well, I merely cite the decisions of this court. The most recent one, very recently, the Raymond Transport Company against Wisconsin, in which a Wisconsin statute was held unconstitutional, or regulation, because it was different from the regulations of other states, thereby imposing a burden on, in that case, the trucking industry. And before that, there have been others, like at Bibb against Navajo Trucking, is another one, the same type of thing. A perfectly valid statute, if it stood by itself, but invalid only because it was incompatible with other states and imposed an unreasonable burden on the interstate commerce that was involved in those cases.
Well, but do you think if neither party had introduced evidence in the recent Wisconsin case, the Wisconsin statute would have been struck down because Wisconsin had the burden of proof to show it was constitutional?
No. The case had to have evidence to show two things. One was what other states were doing, and the second one was that the interplay of Wisconsin and the other states imposed a burden on interstate commerce, and that evidence was in the case.
Mr. Barnes, does the record tell us what the tax rates were? How heavy a tax is it?
In the early years, it was 8%, in the latter years, 10%.
10%.
Pretty stiff rate for a state income tax.
You think it would be unconstitutional to impose a 10% sales tax on?
No. No, you could do that. The appellee hasn't made any case of their own. They've argued that 100% of the income is not taxed. That's wrong. The statute defines the income. And in their brief, they say that the state taxed 100% of the income of local businesses, which it did, but also taxed 100% of the income.
You would be making the same argument, I take it, if this tax rate were 0.5% or 0.01%.
You know, you asked me about that one once before, and the answer here is that in this particular case, the total tax, if they were to tax on gross receipts, which would be a low rate of tax, would be substantially less than the tax that's involved in this case. We applied the Washington statute to these facts and came out way down.
Yes, but why shouldn't a reasonable question be whether or not a state is extracting from Mormon a reasonable return for what it does for Mormon?
There isn't any measure. The sales formula doesn't measure anything that the state does for Mormon, nor any place that Mormon earns the income.
Well, if it were 0.001% rate, you wouldn't say that it was more than what Iowa was doing for Mormon.
Well, if the tax was very low, we wouldn't be quarreling about it. But the legal principles, constitutional principles, would be just the same, assuming they're applying.
Well, unless you say the constitutional principle is that state interstate commerce and Mormon have to pay their way, and the state can, unless somebody can show the state is extracting too much for what it's giving, that this tax is constitutional.
You would have an interstate commerce objection if they taxed their own corporations on the same basis and then exempt them from the tax as the sales factor does, and then but applied it to Mormon. Now, of course, if the amount is very small, nobody's going to complain. That's why gross receipts taxes were allowed to exist for so long.
The Iowa people who are exporting, manufacturing and exporting, are paying property taxes and everything else in Iowa.
Yes, but the...
Their total tax burden imposed by Iowa may be greater than Mormon's, for all you know.
No, but Mormon is paying the same taxes to Illinois, so that there isn't any...
What if Iowa's tax rate was 1% and it had a single factor formula, and Illinois' tax rate were 15%, but it had a three-factor formula? Would your answer as to the constitutionality of Iowa's statute still be the same?
Yes, sir. No difference. the rate and the base are unaffected in an argument of apportion, which is all we're arguing about here. The present situation, then, is that we have a double tax, which is a violation of the Commerce Clause. We have a tax on manufacturing that's out of the state, which violates due process. It also violates fundamental principle of federalism, which confines states to their own geographical jurisdiction, and it favors local industry, which is a violation of equal protection.
Mr. Krager.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The issues today, as far as the constitutionality of the Iowa corporate income tax scheme, resolve itself around the Due Process Clause and Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and the Commerce Clause. Sub-issues are facial constitutionality of the Iowa tax scheme on its face, and then if it is constitutional on its face, whether or not it has been constitutionally applied to Mormon Manufacturing Company.
What do you mean by facial constitutionality?
I believe that facial constitutionality means that it must be constitutional under all, it must be unconstitutional under all conceivable circumstances. If it is simply has a possibility of being unconstitutional some of the time or under some conceivable circumstances, I believe that should be as applied issue. And not is,
that's really overbreath you're talking about, isn't it?
Yes, I believe the whole case is overbreath.
Well, that's only been applied in the First Amendment area, hasn't it? Well, why do you need to wrestle with facial constitutionality at all when you're talking about a tax statute that has nothing to do with free speech?
No, maybe I'm being misunderstood. When this case began, Mormon basically put into issue that the Iowa sales factor is invalid, period, under any conceivable circumstances.
Well, you didn't have to buy that, did you?
No, we don't. And our trial judge in Iowa held that it was unconstitutional under all conceivable circumstances. Our Iowa Supreme Court, which we believe correctly met the issue, said, no, there's no showing it can be facially unconstitutional because it's not facially unconstitutional under all circumstances. And secondly, as to this particular taxpayer, there's been no proof of unconstitutionality. But what I'm saying is, as far as the facial due process issue, this would mean that no matter what the circumstances, the Iowa single sales factor formula would automatically cause extraterritorial taxation, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, regardless of the circumstances. I believe that's what Mormon is saying. That is not our position. We don't think they've proved that in any event. The Iowa single sales factor formula, and exploring this one step further, applies not simply to corporations such as Mormon, which manufacture outside the state of Iowa and sell within. It applies to retail merchants, wholesale merchants, in-state manufacturers, out-of-state manufacturers, manufacturers manufacturing in-state and out-of-state. Mormon's evidence, of course, was only directed toward its own facts, which it agrees on page 4 of its brief that that's all the issues really are. This, as I say, suggests that this case really involves the constitutionality of the Iowa formula as applied to Mormon's facts, and it is too broad to say that it involves an attack upon the statute as invalid under any conceivable circumstances, which are not even before the court today. Due process principles derived from constitutional apportionment cases decided by this court are as follows. First, the statutory formula and the results reached in its application are presumed constitutional, and a taxpayer must show unconstitutionality beyond a reasonable doubt and rebut all reasonable bases to support the formula. Second, the states have great leeway in their choice and application of formula. Third, court has never stricken an apportionment formula on its face. in the 100-some-odd years of constitutional history of formulas in this country, never been stricken on its face, but has adopted the case-by-case approach, carefully reviewing the record in the courts below to see if the taxpayer showed constitutional transgression. A taxpayer has, in this area, not merely the burden of proof, but an extremely heavy burden of proof in challenging a formula's constitutionality. This generally requires a powerful evidentiary showing against the formula, and not merely, as in this case, arguments of counsel. And, of course, precise apportionment is impossible, rough approximation being sufficient, the court having long recognized that it is generally impossible to specifically allocate the profits of a unitary business to activities carried on in a taxing state. Now, an application of these due process principles to this case, for the years in question, the Iowa apportionment formula, as applied to the Iowa computed net income tax base, showed that Moorman earned from about 21.9 or 22% of its income in Iowa to about 18.7% for the 5 years in question. This is stipulated, and there's really no dispute as to the fact that the formula shows that. We believe that Moorman was required to show, to satisfy its burden of proof, that the Iowa law was unconstitutional, that they didn't earn that amount, but they earned a substantially lesser amount. Now, the only evidence in this case, in the stipulated data, there were no witnesses, we have stipulated data in this case, consisted of a mere comparison of the results reached by Moorman's three-factor formula, which is about 12.2 to 14.5% of its income in Iowa, and, of course, the Iowa formula listing the percentages that I mentioned. In other words, we have a comparison of one estimate with another estimate, with no evidence in the case which estimate may be right or which estimate may be wrong. For all that appears in this case, we've actually undertaxed Moorman.
And they it is true, isn't it, General, that your single formula does benefit your Iowa manufacturers. And this, I take it, is why we have an amicus brief from Deere & Co. and Maytag and others who ship out of the state.
I might point out Deere & Co., Maytag is quite local. They manufacture washing machines. Monsanto's located in St. Louis. Most of those...
Well, their headquarters are, but you have an Iowa establishment, don't you, Monsanto?
I believe they do have an Iowa plant. Most of their manufacturing is outside the
state. You certainly do of Deere & Co. at the Quad Cities on the Iowa side.
Deere has manufacturing both in Iowa and in Illinois, yes, sir. They do.
And this is why they're in favor of the single sales formula.
Well, I'm not counsel.
In other words, how do you answer Mr. Barnes' argument that you are not favoring the exporters at the cost of the importers, if there is an answer?
Well, first of all, the only answer I can think of giving on a particular question like that is that you are talking about a theory.
Well, it is a legitimate question.
No, I'm not saying it isn't. I'm not saying it isn't. We're talking about a theory. The same questions cropped up in prior, I believe, anyway, they cropped up in prior apportionment cases decided by this court involving single property factors cases. There, of course, the formula would tax the total segment income if you accept the theory of a company manufacturing in the state, whereas it gives, theoretically in the formula, it doesn't take into account what's going on in the state of sale. Now, Mr. Barnes is saying the same thing insofar as this case. I believe, however, that the Iowa tax is triggered and is applicable against corporations who sell in the Iowa marketplace. And if they do that, they become subject to the Iowa corporate income tax.
Of course, I'm not suggesting Mr. Barnes necessarily will prevail here, but I'm just wondering if the so-called Iowa formula on the single factor isn't the result of the legislative response to Iowa manufacturers.
Your Honor, the formula was adopted in 1934. Why it was adopted, I honestly don't know. Back at that period of time, there were certainly I think, as Mr. Barnes brought out in his brief, back around 1929, there were the basic formula in effect at that time were the single properties and the single sales.
Yes, well, having practiced in a neighboring state, they were adopting these kinds of tax laws at that time, and they were fairly simple, and they went to single factors. Iowa never has progressed beyond that point, I suppose, because it's helpful to them. Now, I'm not saying that's unconstitutional.
No, and in trying to answer your question, it's a little bit difficult for me to point out why we would want to do it. Our Iowa-based companies, Iowa manufacturer who sells totally in Iowa or sells very little out of Iowa, certainly gets no legislative benefit.
Let's put it another way. Wouldn't Mormon be better off if they moved their factory to Iowa?
I don't think we know that. This assumes that they are having...
Really?
No, I don't think we do. That would assume, for example, that they are earning substantial income out of their manufacturing activity. There's no evidence of that. In this particular record, anyway, for all that the record shows here, they could be earning a great deal of money out of their Iowa sales activity, more than we're taxing. And moving their factory to Iowa might not have any effect. Insofar as their overall tax liability is concerned, but it doesn't mean that what we're doing right now is wrong.
Well, it would not increase their Iowa taxes, and it would presumably reduce their Illinois taxes. So why isn't my brother Marshall correct?
Oh, well, I don't think there's any question it would reduce their Illinois taxes.
And it would not increase their Iowa tax. So.
No, unless they increase their Iowa sales, of course.
Well, not just...
But assuming everything remained constant...
Moving their factory to Iowa, they'd come out ahead, wouldn't they? Is my brother Marshall exactly right?
I don't know if they would come out ahead. That assumes that...
Well, they'd not pay that component of the Illinois tax at all, and
no,
they wouldn't pay any increase in Iowa.
Okay, from an economic standpoint, yes.
Do you have a property tax in Iowa?
Oh, yes, sir. One of the highest in the country.
Would they pay Ohio property tax?
Iowa property. Oh, certainly, yes.
And this assumption also would rest on Illinois keeping the same tax that it has now. It isn't likely, but it might abolish its taxes.
They might.
Rescind what they've got now.
They could very well.
And I gather from your reluctance to answer my question that if you did answer, that it'd be better off if you lose your case.
Would Iowa be better off if we lose our case? No.
Yes, sir. I said, do I assume that if you answer my question, yes, you lose your case. And that's why you didn't say yes. You don't have to answer me.
No, I want to answer your question, Your Honor, and let me put it like this, if I may rely on a prior case, the Hans Reese case, in which a taxpayer came in and actually was able to break down the components of his profit and show that a formula, a single property formula in that case, just wasn't any good. And it overreached. Now, if Mormon can make the same showing, fine. We would like this case to simply be treated as the court has been treating apportionment cases for a number of years, on a case-by-case basis. In other words, there is a case, for example, Kent Coffee, where 99% of the income was taxed by the manufacturing state. Now, would that taxpayer be better off if it moved out of, in that case, it was North Carolina? Maybe so, but that didn't make the statute unconstitutional.
General,
in the absence of proof, yes, sir.
Do you think that then the Mormon would be better off or have a better chance of winning this case if it had put some accountants on the stand and proved by cost accounting that part of its net profit is attributable to its manufacturing operations in Illinois? That was Hans Reese, wasn't it?
Yes, Hans Reese did involve, I believe, cost accounting where the evidence was not rebutted by the state. As a lawyer and not being an accountant or an economist, I would have to talk to my own witnesses. And we may very well generate some type of a jury question, for lack of a better description of it, although it would be decided in our case by a judge, as to whether or not they have proved the case. But if we were dealing with the Hans-Reese situation here, we would be dealing with a far different situation than what we're dealing with now.
General, Iowa has not joined the Multi-State Tax Commission yet.
No, we have not joined it. We're neither a regular member nor an associate member. I think they have 19 regular, 13 associate members.
Nor have you been in and out of it, as some states have.
No, we have not. No, sir. Not at all. We believe that the cornerstone of Mormon's argument, the whole case, whether we talk about due process, equal protection, or interstate commerce, rests upon abstract argument of counsel that Iowa necessarily taxed 100% of Mormon's income from Iowa sales of goods manufactured in Illinois. We disagree that Mormon showed that Iowa so taxed this 100% of such income and implicated the facial validity of the Iowa formula.
We'll resume there at 1 o'clock, counsel. Continue, counsel.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Before the recess, I was getting into Mormon's contention that 100% of their income was necessarily taxed by Iowa, that is, income that they derived from selling goods in Iowa, which goods were manufactured in Illinois. One of the points I would like to make in this regard is there is a total lack of evidence in this record as to whether or not there is any manufacturing profit in Illinois. Such lack of evidence was held to be a fatal defect by this court in the Bass case, the Underwood case, Kent Coffee cases, all involving single property factor formulas.
Well, could I just pursue that again? We had an exchange about this before lunch. But if there had been a cost accounting evidence that a part of the profit was assignable to Illinois manufacturing, and assume it was uncontradicted, what would you say then? Could you still use the sales formula?
One of the things I would want to know is how much, because in this sense, the states are allowed rough approximation. If they had manufacturing profit, for example, that we were trying to tax out of all reasonable proportion to business done.
Well, suppose that was a third, third, and third. That's what the accountants testified to. And that on any reasonable accounting basis, a third of the income is assignable to Illinois manufacturing. And then Iowa said, well, we're still going to use the single sales formula. What would you say then?
Well, of course, they could prove it. I think we're getting into a Hans-Reese type situation. It is breaking down the component parts of the business to show
so
what it is.
Are you suggesting that you agree that constitutionally Iowa may not tax income that could be shown to be traceable to the Illinois manufacturing?
Well, I think this is what extraterritorial taxation is all about, is trying to overreach beyond the state. The states have been granted some leeway in this area.
General Greyer, what do you understand Justice White's phrase traceable to Illinois manufacturing to mean when you answer his question?
Well, as I understand, there may not be able to be a precise apportionment to Illinois, but it may be a situation like Hans-Reese where the evidence differed. I think it was between 17% and 21%. Earned in the state of North Carolina in that case, whereas the formula attributed 80-some percent to North Carolina. And the court.
Well, you wouldn't say the evidence like that would be irrelevant or inadmissible, would you?
No, I believe this court.
And if a judge concluded, made findings that based on the evidence before me, one-third of the income is due to manufacturing in Illinois. Now, if there's a finding like that, would you say that you wouldn't conclude, would you argue that Iowa could nevertheless tax that part of the income?
If a finding could be made, I'm not an accountant or an economist, and I might want to consult my own expert witnesses.
Well, I understand, but I understand that. But, if
but I think what you're saying is basically the Hans Reis situation, and yes, the court has already held that would be an
appropriate. Would you understand that such a finding by a trial judge that one-third of the income is, quote, due to, close quote, manufacturing in Illinois to mean economically?
Well, if we can break the business down into its components, that he would actually be making a finding in that instance that the income was can be directly traceable to that activity. Now, generally, this cannot be done in a unitary business. From CPAs I've talked to in our Department of Revenue in Iowa, they say it can't be done.
I take it, when you're talking about the production of copper wire, you have copper that may have been mined in Arizona and Utah, smelted in El Paso, refined somewhere else, and made into wire still somewhere else. It would be kind of hard to ascribe a, quote, due-to, close quote, finding to any one of those activities, wouldn't it?
As I understand it, it would be. I think we were assuming hypothetically it could be done. I don't know that it can be done. But if it could be, then I think we have a burden of going forward with our own evidence. Maybe we can attack that finding, show that it's based on faulty premises. But as I understood his question, if it could be shown, then would we be overreaching by taxing all that income? I suppose the answer would be yes, because the answer was yes in the Hans Reis case. That's at least what I meant my answer to be. I believe that this court has also held, and correctly so, in Ford Motor Company versus Bocamp, that constitutionality of state taxation ought not to turn upon so narrow an issue as to whether local assets rather than local gross receipts are used in an apportionment formula. The presumption of constitutionality must, in this type of a case, in apportionment cases, must be overcome by evidence and not by the argument of counsel to satisfy the heavy burden of proof. I'd like to get on now into the argument in this case involving interstate commerce. Now, again, as far as the Iowa statute is concerned, the basic argument of Mormon, which is that the Iowa formula is bad per se, means that it must necessarily, regardless of the facts, cause multiple taxation to be visited upon Mormon or anybody else for that matter. We believe that the sum and substance of Mormon's argument in this regard is that anybody that deviates from the three-factor formula automatically creates multiple taxation or a risk of multiple taxation. We think Mormon's argument is somewhat inconsistent in that in its brief, on page 25, it says it accepts a single property factor formula, which, of course, is such a deviation. The argument also, we think, assumes that you have an easily definable tax base, such as what you would have in the gross receipts area, where everybody can see the gross receipts, and that is what you are apportioning. That isn't true. What is being apportioned here is net income. A state like Iowa offers what might be called somewhat of a low tax base. We do allow large deductions, including a federal income tax deduction. I don't believe that's allowed by the state of Illinois, for example. It's only allowed by about six states. If we accept Mormon's counsel's argument in this case, we believe that any formula other than a uniform three-factor formula and also a uniform tax base would impale, I should rephrase that, if Mormon's argument were accepted, any formula that would deviate somehow from a uniform formula or a tax base that would be different would somehow create the risk of multiple taxation, destroying the leeway states have in this area, a leeway I might add, and it seems to me that this court has recognized, at least in the area of non-business income and disparate use of combination corporate tax reporting recently in the U.S. Steel Corporation versus multi-state tax commission case decided on February 21st. While that case did involve the compact clause of the Constitution, I believe there were arguments made as to interstate commerce, and the court recognized that states did do things differently, but held that wasn't necessarily bad. Of course, only Congress would have the power in any event to act affirmatively under the Commerce Clause and to, if they wanted to, impose upon all the states a uniform apportionment formula or even a uniform tax base. But that has not been done yet, and the states have and ought to have some leeway in this area in support of their fundamental power of taxation. It's the most fundamental power a state can have, in fact. I would also like to make a few comments about General Motors versus District of Columbia. I think the parties here are agreed that that case did not reach the constitutional issues that are being raised here. In addition, there was no exclusive formula in that case approved by the court. The court read the district statute, which, of course, prescribed no formula, as requiring one which automatically would give effect to the geographical spread of all components of a manufacturing business. There was no overruling of prior constitutional case precedents, particularly the single-factor cases and the Ford Motor case involving the very formula that we have here today. The case does not implicate a taxpayer's heavy burden of proof that a statutory formula is unconstitutional, and we believe that based upon this court's reading of the district statute in that case, that a single property factor probably would have been inconsistent with the statute insofar as applying it to a integrated manufacturing selling business, manufacturing in one state and selling goods in the District of Columbia. We believe that the court's standards on multiple taxation should be derived from the cases of the Northwest Portland Cement case and also its recent case, 1975, the Standard Press Steel case, in which the court seems to be going to an actual burden, and it certainly isn't a mere risk on the basis of argument of counsel, that is an abstract notion of a risk of multiple taxation. For these reasons, we do not feel that the Iowa formula contravenes the Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution. As to facial equal protection, again, this involves that there's necessarily a discrimination against out-of-state manufacturers. No evidence on this issue was introduced. Only extreme hypotheticals were presented by Mormon. It should also be remembered that even if there were some companies along the extreme hypotheticals Mormon presented, that is a company manufacturing totally out of Iowa and then selling in Iowa, or an Iowa manufacturer manufacturing in Iowa and selling totally out of Iowa, that an iron rule of taxation is neither attainable nor required. And that as this court has held, under the Equal Protection Clause, too rigorous a scrutiny ought not to be made, otherwise all taxing schemes would fall, since it's impossible to define any taxing scheme or to make one up which has no discriminatory impact whatsoever. We fail to see that Mormon's argument with reference to that portion of its brief regarding constitutionality as applied is any different from that portion of its brief with reference to facial constitutionality. The Iowa Supreme Court agreed with us in that regard, and because they held that the Iowa formula was not proven bad on its face, they also held that Mormon did not satisfy its burden of proof to overturn the formula. Conclusion, we believe that the decision of the Iowa Supreme Court is correct and that it ought to be affirmed by this court.
Well, Barnes, you have one
Thank you.
Minute remaining.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, that 1 minute is quite sufficient. The arguments that have been made are all adequately answered in our briefs and reply brief. But I want to emphasize to the court one thing, that the director here is challenging the assumption which is inherent in the statute. We didn't make any assumption. The statute makes it. That assumption is that the income derived with respect to any dollar of sales is the same as income derived from any other dollar of sales. And that is the basis for the attribution of income to the income-producing activities in Illinois. They keep arguing for separate accounting. Of course, this court has held that separate accounting is impermissible in the case of a unitary business. Hans Reese was not a unitary business.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.